Hello and welcome or welcome back, whatever the case might be. We're so pleased to have all of you here. Thanks again to Professor Stephanie Creery for the engaging presentation that many of us just heard. So I'm now pleased to introduce Jose Villalba, who will be moderating our panel discussion focused on diversity, character, and the professions. Jose is the Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion and the Chief Diversity Officer, as well as a professor of counseling here at Wake Forest. He has authored or co-authored over 50 manuscripts, book chapters, and editorials about health disparities in Latina and Latino youth, Latina and Latino access to and completion of higher education options, and issues related to college access for students from underrepresented groups. Since becoming an administrator, he has facilitated diversity and inclusion efforts for students, staff, and faculty in an effort to address issues of access and equity across campus. And I cannot imagine anyone better suited to host and moderate this conversation than Jose. It's all yours.
Thanks a lot, Kenneth. No pressure, right? Especially on a Friday evening after 5 o'clock. Good evening, and thank you so much for being part of this conference and part of this mutual exchange of information and ideas. As Kenneth said, my name is Jose Villalba. I use he, him pronouns, and I'm the VP for D&I. More importantly, I love this topic. I appreciate the fact that we have had a chance to learn and grow over the last hour, and more importantly, that we've had a chance to grow as individuals over the past couple of days. It is truly a pleasure to have a panel of experts and a panel of devoted individuals to these topics, not just because it's timely, although it is, and not just because it's important, although it is, but also because it moves our society forward. They are the manifestations of character and virtues in a way that I'm not sure that other things are. So I'm humbled to be here, and I'm grateful to be here. In a second, I'm going to turn it over to Stephanie so that she can reintroduce herself, and then our panelists will go ahead and introduce themselves in the order that they are listed. Because this is Zoom world, it's very hard to wait for someone to get some sort of visual cue that it's their turn to go. And so we will keep that order as I ask questions of the panelists. And we hope that this provides for as clear a point of engagement as possible. And I believe Kenneth mentioned it before, but this part of the session today won't be open for questions. It really is my chance to engage with these three professionals and these three experts in this area. And so if you do have some sort of question or feedback, Kenneth may or may be able to drop something in the chat that can get that information to you, or maybe like down the road, but it really is going to be a dialogue between four individuals. So without further ado, Stephanie, I'm going to pass it over to you so that you can reintroduce yourself, and then we'll keep going that way.
Okay.
Perfect. Good to see you.
I'm here now. And when you said the opportunity to Stephanie to reintroduce herself, I was just waiting for Dr. Creery to come back on and just join the panel.
It's actually a joke. I've had several colleagues today say, is that the Stephanie Pender Emiger? And so your reputation precedes you. I've had a lot of fan person reaching out, going, I can't wait for her to talk. So that's what I'm all about.
And to figure out how to turn on and off the mute button. But I don't know who your colleagues are, but thank you. I'm so delighted and honored to be here and to be this panel. I can't imagine. There are a few opportunities that I would take to spend a Friday evening giving a talk or Friday, except for this. And then what an honor to follow that incredible keynote by Dr. Creery. Really appreciated and resonated with so much of what she had to say. My name is Stephanie Pender Emiger, and I am McLean Hospital's Chief Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Officer. I am also McLean's founding director of their college mental health program and an assistant professor of psychology at Harvard Med School. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Jose, do I just go next?
Yes, you go next. Thank you.
Okay, great. Okay, I was fantastic. Hi, everyone. My name is Naran Han. I use she, her pronouns. I'm director in the Office of the President at the Ford Foundation. I'm also vice chair of the board of the Girl Scouts of the USA. And I'm very excited to be here. I think we all need more conversations about character in our lives. And so I've been an eager observer and listener to the rest of this and learner along the way. I'm so happy to contribute to this conversation. Because I get to introduce myself, I'm also just gonna embrace a little more of a DEI best practice. So I'm gonna describe myself for those that are blind or visually impaired. I am a mid-30s Pakistani American woman with long brown hair, and I have kind of a hold up in a cabin. So that's my background. I'm thrilled to be here and very eager for this conversation. And I'll now kick it to Eboo.
Hello, everyone. My name is Eboo Patel. I'm founder and president of an organization called IFYC, Interfaith Youth Corps. We work with people from a range of different religious backgrounds to engage in interfaith cooperation to solve social problems and to strengthen America. I am 5'11", Indian American Muslim Ismaili male, in small hoop earring in each ear, rapidly graying hair because a very active and lovely 13 and almost 11-year-old boys.
Thank you, Eboo. Thank you, Noor. And thank you, Stephanie. And Stephanie, I think we have a really interesting challenge. So I'm gonna reintroduce myself and give some physical characteristics as well. And then Stephanie, you can do that too. So
thank you.
My name's Jose. Like I said before, I'm 5'9 on a good day. I am Latino background. So I am brown skin complexion. My mom is Cuban, my dad's Colombian. It's important to my identity. And I'm holed up not in a cabin, but in a guest room, which you can't see because there's a virtual backdrop of the Wake Forest University Wake Chapel at sunset. So I'm not on the quad, I'm in my office, but you can't see it. Thank you. Stephanie, what about you?
Thank you all for modeling DEI best practice and inclusivity. Again, my name is Stephanie. I identify as a Black African-American cisgender female. I'm about 5'5". I think I'm still 5'5", maybe shrinking a little bit to 5'4.5". I am brown skin, and I am sitting where I have been working and running my hospital program from home for a year now, almost a year to the date, in a living room, in a soothing, calm, quiet setting.
Thank you, Stephanie. Thank you, Noor, and thank you, Eboo. So Stephanie Creary, Professor Creary, really gave us a lot to chew on and a lot to think about, from the research that she shared towards the end of her talk to how she started, really, talking about the framework that she shared with us, and even going further back to how this work manifests and how rewarding it can be. And it is pretty rewarding, and also how challenging it can be. So I'd like to actually start there. There was a point in her discussion, early on in her discussion, where she mentioned this notion of cultural fit and how sometimes we may feel a certain pressure or challenge or thoughts around fitting into an organization and how that rubs up against our virtues, right? The virtues we were raised with, the virtues that we got in higher education, or as my father would say, indigenous education. And so thinking about the virtues that you've brought up along the way and how that sometimes tenses up or impacts the cultural fit of the professional world, how might you describe your own challenges and maybe successes in navigating those tensions between your virtues and maybe wanting to fit in or feeling a need to fit in your professional setting? Stephanie, I believe you're up first.
Sure, it's such a good question. And, you know, we talked, and actually Dr. Cleary spoke earlier about sort of professional identity. And we think a lot about how, you know, virtues within professional identity help to keep folks whole when they come in and out of various occupations and workspaces. I think about it a little bit in reverse. For me, I think about the importance of, and part of that's a psychologist and the nature of the work that, I do, which is that we spend a lot of time these days working with young people to help them think about various aspects of their social cultural identity. So as some high school students recently rephrased for us, like your personal identity or the things you get to choose, like your favorite color or your favorite book, but your social identity are the things that you inherit, like your race, ethnicity, gender expression, national origin, sexual orientation, and so forth. And so I think for me, I think about the evolution. First of all, I can't imagine a time when I didn't want to be a psychologist. I've known since I was 14 years old that this was my chosen profession. So it's really difficult for me to unpack some of these things. They're so intertwined because developmentally, I was literally still developing my personality while I had already made up in my mind, like, this is professionally who I'm going to be. But I would just say that at the core, for me, it's been and continues to be most important to think about the aspects of my identity that are most salient and are most meaningful for me. For me, they happen to be, you know, I mentioned at the introduction, I identify as Black, cisgender, African-American woman. My race, my ethnicity, and my gender are three aspects of my identity in which, through which I experience historically, categorized as historically marginalized, at least in the United States. But they are also aspects of my identity through which I derive tremendous strength and courage. And so knowing what we know now about how important it is to make sure that there is people have a real solid sense of the social cultural identities that are meaningful to them, that in fact correlates very closely with mental health and well-being, we're in a position now to go back and help younger kids work on this, right? So we didn't have to figure it out, you know, by accident, as many did, so who came along in my direction. But now we get to work with younger kids and help them to think about themselves in terms of social cultural identity, what's meaningful, what matters, and to specifically be able to name and claim the strengths that they derive from those most meaningful aspects of their social cultural identity. And so I feel like when that foundation is in place, when that foundation, I'll speak for myself personally, with that intact, I have the ability to strive to be virtuous in my profession, to enter any professional challenge or space. Academic medicine is the space in which I, you know, live and navigate, in spite of potential barriers, obstacles, and biases.
Thank you so much, Stephanie. It made me think a little bit about when you were talking about leaning into your own cultural identity and your social identity. Not only it's important for you and that's how you show up, but also modeling it for young folks, since you talked about teenagers and high schoolers. And I kept thinking to myself, Jose, this is not a workshop between you and Stephanie as counselor and psychologist talking about the next generation. This is a workshop where Noren and Ibu also get to talk. So I'll be quiet now and turn it over to Noren and let her share the answer to her question.
Jose, I'm hoping you'll restate the question.
Sure. It is going back to that time when you feel like you've brought in your virtues and your whole self into the workplace, and realizing that there may be some tension or some expectation that your cultural fit needs to fit with that workplace.
Sure, sure. I mean, I think we all move about in the world thinking about context. We are who we are, whether it's our social life, our professional life, you're kind of always resituating yourself in your context. And there's always going to be tensions, opportunities, things to navigate. And I've had the privilege of having a couple different professions, I would say. I'm trained as a lawyer. I actually worked in private corporate law for a couple of years. Very different vibe than the nonprofit sector. And now I'm in, you know, private philanthropy. And I would just say, you know, I wouldn't make any assumptions about one culture. For example, a culture of a nonprofit being more virtuous or open or, you know, perfect for someone to fully embrace who they are. I think there is so much that is intentional about the spaces you're in, and it's about leadership. It's about whatever core values are manifested. It's about your peers. And so I think a lot of folks might just be like, oh, well, like that's, you know, that's the private sector. This is the public sector. You know, this is how you can, you know, most fully profess yourself. And it might seem like it would be in a space that's, you know, professes certain values. And that was certainly not the case. I think you can be very, very intentional about culture where you are. And just to be more specific and on point, I'm just going to speak with a really concrete example. Like I don't drink alcohol. I'm a practicing Muslim. It's very important to who I am. I also observe Ramadan by fasting. I actually found at my law firm that was like a more easier thing to explain and observe because I actually had a lot of colleagues that were Orthodox Jews who were, you know, had really, you know, specific practices. And when I like explained what my situation was, it was so much easier for kind of everyone to understand what my parameters were, much more so sometimes than even operating in other spaces where you'd think that people would get stuff. So I guess what I'm just saying is we can control a lot of our culture. We ourselves as leaders, as staff, as, you know, just like people in a workplace. And I would just encourage people to think about the ownership and intentionality that they have access to wherever they are in a hierarchy or in a kind of sphere of public space.
Thank you for that response. I appreciate not only where you started, not assuming that just because you work at a nonprofit or just because you work at a school or higher ed, that it's some sort of kumbaya place where everybody understands and values diversity and inclusion, which we know is not always true, but towards the end, how you reminded us that you can bring that authenticity and that culture and be authentic. And in a lot of ways, expect for others to reciprocate that, right? And I think for me, it's liberating, and I appreciate that. I also want to make sure that I am pronouncing your first name correctly.
So great. It's Naran. It's spelled Naran. It's never going to be like very straightforward, but thank you for even asking. That's great.
You're welcome. My parents gifted me with an interesting last name. So Naran, I appreciate you helping me with that. All right, Ibu. I'm going to repeat the question for your benefit. That's that time, that tension when you get to a place, a profession, and you want to bring that authentic self and you're wondering, what do I do to fit in? What do I not do to fit in?
Yeah, so thank you for that question. Thank you for having me on this panel. Such a blast. So I'll give a couple concrete examples. So I started getting interested in religious diversity when I was 19, 20 years old in college. I was kind of struck that for all the attention paid to different dimensions of diversity in the early to mid 1990s when I was an undergrad, and it was an inflection point in identity discourses. Feels a lot like now, actually. You know, you couldn't walk 10 feet, even at the University of Illinois, which is not the most vanguard campus on these issues. You couldn't walk 10 feet without running into somebody reading Bell Hooks or Cornel West, right? And of course, those are classics now, and people are reading Ibram X. Kendi and Ta-Nehisi Coates, but it was a similar moment. A couple years into college, it kind of occurred to me how important religious identity and diversity was in the world, the role that it played in ugly movements for extremism and also really positive movements for social justice and for civic strengthening. I became more interested in interfaith work. And I started going to interfaith conferences when I was 20 or 21, and they just bored the bejeebers out of me, right? They were just people on panels talking. And I say that, ironically, tongue in cheek, because that is all that I do now. I am a dude on a panel talking all the time, like 7 times a week. And that's not exaggerating, right? But back when I was 20 or 21, I was like, this is boring the bejeebers out of me. And I want to do interfaith work, but I don't want to do it this way. And so I'm going to start my own thing. And it wasn't like that kind of snap easy, but like at some, you know, my idea was I wanted to have a different, I wanted to engage religious diversity, but I wanted to do it with a different focus, young people and social action, not so much theologians and pontificating. And I wanted it to feel different. I wanted it to feel edgy. I wanted it to feel exciting. I wanted it to feel urgent. I wanted it to, you know, to feel like I would imagine SNCC felt, you know, in 1963, or the Catholic Worker felt in 1938, you know. So I built my own thing. And actually our first grant came from Ford, $35,000 from a young Muslim woman in 2002. And I'm super grateful for that. And I realize now that part of what I did, and a lot of it is privilege, and some of it is just like straight up, like, you know, smoke and mirrors confidence, is I didn't like that other culture. And so I built something that is more consistent with the culture that I do like. And I'm sure that there's a set of people that come to IFYC who don't, it doesn't jive with them, you know? And we're like a super fast paced place. You know, if you're up at 7, you probably have, and you're on the senior team, you probably have 7 emails from me already. And that's not an overstatement, you know? Like I'm up at 5 a.m. and I'm just like Mach 5 all the time. And there are people that doesn't connect with. And I think a very interesting question is, if an entire profession does not connect with an entire identity group, let's say women, right? My wife is an Indian Muslim woman in the law, not unlike Naran, right? Narain. The legal profession at senior partner levels is not especially friendly to women, right? That's a problem. If a particular organization is very fast paced, in part because of the personality of the founder, and it's a 40 person shop, is that okay? You know, so I think it's interesting to ask questions like Wake Forest has a culture, and I've been at enough college campuses to know that Wake Forest has a culture that's different than WashU, than Harvard, than the University of Miami. I think an interesting question is part of the strength of a diverse civil society that different institutions have distinct cultures. And as long as those cultures are reasonably welcoming to diverse identity groups. So if Wake Forest was only for Southerners, right? Or only for Indian American immigrants, that's not good. But if Wake Forest can articulate its distinctive character and say to a prospective student, hey, listen, if you don't want to reflect on character, that's okay. But Wake Forest is a place where we do that, and we push our students to do that. It's part of our culture, right? So I think I'm proud of, I am, one of the things that makes me different than I was when I was 22, 23 starting IFYC is I appreciate the culture of those organizations that I was dismissive of 25 years ago. That doesn't mean I want to be a part of them, but they get to have their own culture as long as it is relatively open to people from a range of identity groups. And you've got people who say, you know, I'm gay and Black, and I feel like I fit here. I'm Latina and female and young, and I feel like I fit here. It doesn't feel alien to any identity group. I think places get to have their own culture. And I think that a healthy civil society is a place with a range of institutions with particular cultures that figure out how to be in a reasonable cooperation with each other.
Thanks, Ibu. And thank you for articulating the power of a culture within a community, within an organization, the organizational culture that any place can have, right? So this is a shift. And as you were sharing, and as Stephanie and Iran have shared as well, I have a follow-up question for you, Stephanie, based on culture shifts. You work in a medical setting, and Niran, I know you work in a nonprofit, and Ibu, I know you own your own shop. I got your own shop, 40 people, right? So this is the lens that I'm coming at. There were six virtues, six factors that Professor Currie shared. They were courage, justice, humanity, temperance, transcendence, and wisdom. Courage, justice, humanity, temperance, transcendence, and wisdom. Thinking about your specific shops, your specific places where you're engaged in now, I'm assuming that you've done something to change some culture in that space. Tweak it, improve it, a little bit of this, a little less of that. Which one of those six, or whichever one you want to talk that isn't those six, have you used in changing that culture? And Stephanie, for the better. I'm not throwing shade, as the kids would say, on the health professions or the medical system, but I imagine you've instituted a little bit of change in your time in your space. Can you think of which one of those six you maybe leaned on a little bit extra to institute some of that cultural shift, some of that cultural change?
This is really a tough question because it's a toss-up between courage and wisdom. But if I had to pick one, and it sounds like you are pushing me to pick one, I'm going to go with wisdom. And especially as it was operationalized and described earlier by Dr. Currie. And now I'm torn. Now I'm like, oh, but courage is so important too. But I'm going to go with wisdom. No, I'm going to stick with wisdom. And I'm going to say wisdom, particularly the ability to model a term that we've coined recently called empowered listening, to really hear and learn from the lived and shared experiences of others, and to be able to pivot, to hear that feedback and alter course. We have instituted a number of new initiatives in our hospital this year. We launched an anti-racist justice and health equity action plan, for example, for the organization. Our organization happens to be 220 years old. And this work has never been done before in this way. I'll give you an example of where I think wisdom really helped out. One of the things we decided to do early, like all scientist practitioners, is that we wanted to gather more data. And we decided that we wanted to launch a listening tour you can't, everything that's faced can't be changed, but nothing can be changed until it's faced. And that we felt throughout the organization, there was tremendous need for people to have a deeper understanding specifically of the lived, observed, and supervised experiences of racism within our organization. And we had to have some real sort of internal assessment and reckoning with not only our own institutions' role in contributing to injustice and bias as an institution, but also the field in which we sit of psychiatry, which also has its own track record of bias and injustice, and then within the context of medicine, which has an atrocious track record. We can just go on and on, but we needed to understand our own history as part of that process. So we embarked on this listening tour, and it was really designed to be like a almost a controlled study, very structured. We were in there to really create brave spaces for people to come forward and share the truth of their experiences over time in our organization. And we did a lot of preparation, a lot of training. We developed training for our leaders. We know from the research literature that when leaders make themselves available to really lean in and hear and listen to the experiences of marginalization, bias, and oppression of members of their organization, that it can really contribute to culture shift. So we knew that that was important, but that our leaders first needed to be trained so that they could hear in a non-oppressive way. Okay, the wisdom part came in that we designed this process very systematically to ensure that we covered every single program and unit within our organization, right? So very comprehensive, very structured the way we were going to go about this. But we began to hear back from people within the different parts of the organization who had the courage, frankly, to come forward in one way or another and say, you know what, I really want to participate in this listening tour, but I don't feel so safe doing it in the context of my particular program. And therefore, I'm probably not going to participate. And this thing was so meticulously designed, like a research study at this point, right? We pivoted, not just as in reaction to that, but we heard a few other things. And on a dime, we scrapped the entire, not the plan for the listening tour, but the structure, the procedures, the ways that we were going to go about it. And instead, we redesigned sessions that were identified by affinity group. So people could choose rather than, and so no, it wasn't as structured and systematic, and we didn't hit every single department within the hospital, but we heard that feedback and we modeled. I think this takes some degree of wisdom to be able to say, you know what, we got that wrong. And rather than go through with our well thought out plan, we are going to pivot and we're going to model and say, we're going to redesign it to and model empowering listening that we heard from those. We want to empower those who came forward to share their apprehension about participating and redesign the approach. So I'd say that's a specific example of a subpart of wisdom, I think, is also being able to say, like, I think that was wrong, or to be able to apologize, make an authentic, empowered apology, which goes along with empowered listening. And it's a skill and a trait that many managers and leaders could really, you know, develop in a more intensive way.
Thank you, Stephanie. I chuckled when you said apologize. I'm known around Wake Forest for trying to get my colleagues to say, my bad, I'm sorry. Try it on for size, it's not the end of the world.
Right.
It means a lot. The thing that I really appreciate when you shared this notion of empowered listening, you can't hear the wisdom if you're not listening for it. And they really do go hand in hand. So I really appreciate that. By the way, you also got courage in there, which I also appreciate. Acknowledge that as well. Miran, what about you?
Great. Well, I really appreciate the framework offered. And I would submit one that kind of relates to all of them, which is humility. And I think that we all, you know, we all make change in ways big and small wherever we are. And one of the examples I'll share is that in addition to my work running the discretionary fund at Ford, I also oversee our global work in disability rights. And like 5 years ago, I didn't know like one thing about disability rights. And, you know, the Ford Foundation announced a new strategy focused on inequality in 2015. And it was like big fanfare, lots of press releases, lots of framework. Like, we're so excited. We can't wait to tell the world. And in that, we also shared a kind of framework about what we think drives inequality. And one of those things was persistent prejudice and discrimination. And we identified all these different intersections of identity that we we said contributed to that. Race, class, gender, because we work in South Asia, caste. We didn't say anything about disability. And we started to hear from disability rights activists around the world. And they were mad. They were super mad. And it wasn't like friendly mad, like, hey guys, like, you should check this out. It was like, hypocrites, you guys are not going to be able to deliver on your baby's crying, don't worry, it's a little toddler, she's really cool, but she wants to be involved here, and she's very passionate about disability rights too. Okay, so people were like super mad, and I think like watching my boss Darren Walker in action, like I would have been like, okay, you guys don't have to be so mean about this, that's not the point. Like, they were totally right. And I think the humility manifested when it was just like about listening and being like, okay, like, doesn't matter how the feedback comes to you. Like, you kind of don't have a right to have an opinion about it. You got to like take it in, listen, and figure out what you're going to do about it. And so that led to a series of things, which I'm so excited and passionate to share. You know, we have limited time here, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. And we've been pretty methodical about documenting the journey along the way. Like, it's always my inclination to like wait till you get it right and then you can talk about it and then you can talk about what you learned. But like every year since then, we've been able to be like, okay, this is what we did right, this is what we did wrong, this is what people are mad about, this is what we're proud of. And I think all of that is kind of imbued with humility. And I think that's just like such an important, like, you got to be able to say like, I did this wrong, this is so embarrassing, mea culpa, like all of that stuff. And I don't think that's like my natural inclination, because I think a lot of folks are like, even well-meaning folks are like, I want to get this right, I don't want to offend anyone. And it's just like, sometimes it's just like about not waiting and perfecting and just like doing the work and working with the right people, hiring the right people. And so I can go on and on about that. But Jose, I know you had a very discreet question, so I feel like I answered it, and happy to talk more about any of that.
So yes, you answered it, and your child also backed it all up. So completely handled with aplomb. The humility point is interesting, and thank you for sharing that experience with the Ford Foundation, where it's not that you didn't hit your mark, you just missed it a little bit, right? And people gave you this constructive feedback. Oh, by the way, you could have done this a little bit different or whatever.
We didn't hit the mark, Jose. Like, we were not hitting the mark. Like, so, it was, so, you know, it's okay. Like, that's okay. Like, as long as you can pivot and leave yourself the room to be able to claim that. That's very generous of you. But I just want to be honest. Like, it's pretty glaring when, like, you know, 20% of the world's population is disabled and they experience the most extreme forms of inequality, and you come out with a you know, proposal you're really proud of addressing that, and you don't address the needs of a pretty significant part of the population. So that's very kind of you, but I have to say, like, it was bad.
Good. Well, then thank you for saying it was bad. It's interesting. A couple of years ago, I had the privilege of hearing Ibram Kendi speak, who Ibu referenced a few minutes ago, and one of the things that he really emphasized is this notion of intent versus impact. Well, it wasn't my intention, so I'm not sorry, right? And so, you know, we've been trading in that currency of, it wasn't my intention, so I get to ignore the impact that it's had. And what you've demonstrated for us through humility, through courage, I'm still going to courage, Stephanie, because frankly, it's my favorite, to be able to say, this is actually something we did wrong. And by the way, Jose, we don't need an out. We acknowledge the fact that it didn't go very well. And more importantly, this is the impact that it had. There's virtue in that. There's character in that, as much as we'd like to not get that constructive feedback. So, Lauren, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Ibu, coming back at you. Your organization, 40 people strong, that shop. Of those six that we've shared, which one are you leaning on to create that cultural shift or change?
So I'm gonna take a version of courage, but I'm gonna juice that in a particular way. There's probably, and when I was preparing for this, the four words that kept coming to me, that if I don't share these four words, I will not have done my job, is this. Power can be generous. Power can be generous. And I think that there is, it is not a bad thing to acquire and to hold power. It is a bad thing to not be generous if you have it, right? And I think a form of generosity is dealing with people's unfriendly anger in a humble way and revising. I mean, that's a, you know, I know Darren a little bit, and I know Hillary a little bit, and I know Naran a little bit, and there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of generosity there, right? The Ford Foundation has a lot of power in the social sector, and if you're powerful, you ought to be generous, right? And it is okay to have power, but it is not okay to have power and to not be generous. And I think that the reason that that matters for institutional leaders is because one of the ways that you get to being an institutional leader is you play the game really well. And we all know that the game is unfair. And the question is, when you get to a leadership level, are you going to do things that are a little bit different? Are you going to be generous in ways that show courage? And so I'm going to give a very concrete example of this, right? The vast majority of institutions who have the moniker excellence attached to them, whether it's a university or a foundation or whatever, they get to that by rejecting lots of people. They literally brag about the number of people that they reject. So, and I don't know, I have no brief for the person I'm about to mention, but Michael Crow goes from Columbia to Arizona State. I've never met the guy. Okay, so I have no brief for him at all. But he goes from Columbia to Arizona State and he starts getting, you know, advice on, you know, how do you make a university more excellent? And everybody says, you figure out a way to drop the bottom third of your freshman class, right? And you here's how you go about raising test scores and here's how you blah, 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 right? And at some point, Michael Crow like basically thinks the same thing that honestly, virtually every 14-year-old must think about education, that this is crazy, right? Like all my teachers talk about being kind and inclusive and like second step and be an upstander, not a bystander. And they keep on talking about like going to colleges who take pride in rejecting 9 out of 10 applicants, all of them who have like had a million sleepless nights along the way. And it is just the pinnacle of obviousness. It is just obvious to say, this is nuts. Why are we hanging our reputation on the number of people we reject? It is utter craziness. And it is in deep and profound conflict with every value at the heart of any of these institutions. So at IFYC, I walk around saying, find a way to say yes. Find a way to say yes. So we give a lot of mini grants away at IFYC. What happens if we get an application that's not bullseye, not on par? Find a way to say yes. Don't do it in a way that lowers the excellence of the organization. We really pride ourselves on being excellent. But if we are going to pride ourselves on being the kind of excellence that finds a way to say yes and helps raise standards along the way. And the thing about it is that, again, it is like utterly obvious that saying no to lots of smart and good people is an exercise in exclusivity. And it takes a little bit of creativity to be in a position of power and to say, I'm not gonna do things the exact same way, at least in this regard, right? So power can be generous and find a way to say yes. That, you know, and we don't get it right all the time, but you know, I'll say, we don't do high school internships at IFYC, but if a significant donor asks us, we find a way to do it. Okay, so if we can do it for that person, why can't we do it for other people? And by the way, we're not the only nonprofit that does that. Every place does favors for the people who do favors for them. But if I can do a favor for your kid, I can figure out how to do a favor for the person, the 16-year-old who just, you know, read an essay by a staff member at IFYC and was super inspired and emails me out of nowhere and says, how can I be involved? I could figure that out too, right? I could find a way to say yes.
It's an incredible gauntlet you've thrown down, Ibu, right? And it's got me thinking about,
I'm sorry, I have to unmute. That was fantastic, Ibu. Like if we were on a live panel and we didn't have to like mute and look, you know, like look at each other, like absolutely, totally. And that's like just the wrong framework of operating in way too many institutions. Even public institutions operate that way. It's heartbreaking and it's shameful actually. So just plus one all of that.
Yeah. And I don't mean it as like, I don't mean it as a weird challenge, right? You know, I know I'm at Wake Forest. I know that we're at Wake Forest. We're at an elite institution. I love Wake Forest, right? I love the Ford Foundation, even though only 1 out of 10 of my grant requests gets accepted. But I love, I'm a Rhodes Scholar. I've lived in the world of exclusivity, right? Like I am made by that world. But at some point you wake up and you're like, wait a second. I don't want to like rest my reputation on saying no to people, you know?
Or if you had like UCLA accepting like 60% of their students 30 years ago and 9% this year, and like, you know, in this year, like this, like public institutions really, I mean, I don't want to distract us, but it is actually a really relevant part of the DEI conversation. Who has access to what and why?
No, and Naran, I don't think you're distracting us at all. You mentioned UCLA. I went to the University of Florida and I used to joke and say, I could never get in today. And there's two realities there. The reality is I could not get in today. And the other reality is, but had I not gone into UF, I would not be having this privilege right now, this unearned privilege of being talking with you all and engaging with this group of individuals. Mm-hmm. And when that settles in, Ibu, it's apologies if I reframed it incorrectly as a challenge or a gauntlet, because my take on it for the work that I do is, how do we increase the yeses, right? And it's not a zero sum game, right, Ibu? It's not a binary. It's how do we get a little bit more yes, and how do we even reframe the concept of yes? So you can hijack the conversation whenever you want.
I just meant by gauntlet. I just meant like that wasn't meant to be that was meant, that honestly wasn't meant to be a critique. That was of anybody, right? That was meant to be like wait a second, like how is it that like we are all a part of this? Yeah. We're all a part of this. Yeah. And actually, in healthcare, healthcare has experienced the revolution remarkably in the last year, because literally, like I live in Chicago, right? And so you have these hospitals who brag about like, you know, the famous rich people who fly in from other continents to do to get their surgeries at their hospitals, right? And now as a result of activists, they, you know, activists are like, you can't figure out how to take care of people down the block from you, and like you're gonna like have commercials about how some billionaire from London flew in. What are you like? why don't you figure that out?
Yeah.
Thank you so much for this discussion. So I've got an additional question. I love this because we're burning through time like there's no tomorrow, right? And so this is great. This may be the last question I get. So one of the things that all three of you have shared in your own ways is how tiring this work can be, regardless of our virtues, regardless of what we bring in, whether or not you're open to getting that constructive feedback, it's still constructive. Never mind the folks who don't want to change. Stephanie, when you were talking about an institution that's 220 years old, that's a lot, right? Yeah. So a colleague of ours on this panel wrote a book recently. Did that just happen? Beyond Diversity, Creating Sustainable and Inclusive Organizations. Stephanie, I told you had some fans, but this is why you need to get a chance to get it reintroduced. And incidentally, your co-author, Lauren Wadsworth, was also part of this book, right? This isn't just a shameless product plug. This is actually, I'm going somewhere with this, Stephanie. So here we go. How can we sustain ourselves and our organizations to get beyond diversity, to get beyond inclusion? Note, lately we were talking about getting beyond equity into justice, diversity, inclusion, equity, and justice. High bar, higher bar, higher bar, higher bar. How do we sustain ourselves? Mm-hmm. And when we get people to really buy into this, how do we sustain them? you can mention virtues, you don't have to mention virtues, you can talk about whatever, but how do we do that?
Such a good question. And title of one of the chapters in the book. And it's so important because as people often say in DEI work, that this work requires both a commitment of the head and the heart. And just by definition, I don't think I have to say much more to convey like what that might mean on a day-to-day basis. It's why the courage part is so important. I think it takes a lot of courage to utilize both your head and heart to bring both aspects of yourself to your work and your profession every single day. But sustainability is really important. And there's so many things I'll say first that organizations can do. And one is to openly prioritize the work. And I mean, like, not quietly, like a full-throated verbal public commitment, something that like the president of our hospital modeled really well this year. Everywhere he went, whether it was to our Board of Regents, to our president's cabinet, to our town hall, you know, community meetings, which the entire organization was present, he made it clear in no uncertain terms that addressing racism and promoting health equity and justice as our organization was the top priority from this point forward. And he didn't, you know, couch the words. He was just so clear about it. So that's one piece of it. We know from the research how important it is for leaders to be very clear about how they prioritize this work. But another companion to sustainability is an important part of that message, which is creating a culture, an organizational culture and structure that recognizes that this work belongs to everyone. That there isn't, you know, the chief diversity, equity, inclusion officer over there, or this DEIO office over here, or the office for equity and health equity over there. And it's their job, it's their responsibility. But to create a real sense of this is everyone's job in our organization, in our community. Every person needs to wake up every day thinking about what's my responsibility, what's my contribution to creating a more just, a more equitable organization today. What can I do? How am I going to contribute to this effort? So it's like a shared leadership model, a shared responsibility. And if organizations can move even the slightest bit in that direction, it will go a long way toward sustaining those who have been in the trenches, as was mentioned earlier, doing this work for a very, very long time. So openly prioritize, create or espouse and promote a shared responsibility model. And then another thing that is sort of easy to say and often overlooked, properly resource the work and access. What I love was that, Dr. Creary introduced herself as a DEI scholar. And so often we forget when it comes to this work that that scholarship, that expertise exists. And too often organizations look inward and tack the responsibility on to members of the organization who are already potentially burdened and marginalized, and look to those individuals and assume, because they maybe identify as having a disability or as being a BIPOC employee, that they also hold some sort of expertise in this area. And then we anoint them as the experts within our organization and say, you go ahead, now it's your job to fix this. Instead of properly tapping, and that doesn't mean that they don't have the expertise, but, you know, access the tremendous body of literature and just brilliance that exists and has existed for some time in this growing area. Bring the necessary expertise and pay for it. Put your money where your mouth is. If you value DEI work, then properly resource it. Those things collectively, I think, will go a long way towards sustainability.
Stephanie, thank you for that. The excitement, the genuine excitement that you share talking about that topic and describing it as empowering others through resource allocation, promoting it. You can tell that that is how you stay sustained. This work can be so debilitating from time to time that it is important to have that leadership. The one thing that I appreciate you giving all of us on this call is permission to promote. You know, we talk about humility. That's my own family of origin stuff. And particularly as a counselor, I'm not supposed to be a promoter. And yet if we don't say something about this work, if we don't espouse its value and its impact, then it's lost on those who don't value it. And it deaffirms those who do. So appreciate your wisdom, to go back to your word. Thank you so much. You're welcome. Ron, same question for you. How do you sustain yourself in this work and an organization that may or may not be new to this?
I mean, find what makes you joyful in the work, create community. And like, if the community doesn't arise naturally out of the work, seek it out, cultivate it, spread the work around. I mean, I think that like a lot of people who are passionate about mission take a lot on themselves. Like, I think, you know, shared responsibility and accountability is really important. But like, I just, like in my own daily work, like I find it's super important for me to feel like optimistic, hopeful, positive, and to kind of make sure those around me have that available to them, have that as part of their day to day. So, and then I guess just like DEI work, broadly speaking, like whatever you want to call that, is not just about confronting all of your own shortcomings or, you know, confront, you know, calling people out all the time. Like I think some of the frameworks that we, or some of the strategies and best practices are, can feel punitive. And on the other side, there's so much joy and celebration and things to experience and ways to see the world you don't normally have access to. And you don't want like all DEI work just to be like the whatever party for whatever culture. Like that's not substantive either. But I think there's like room for a balance and to find, to make the work joyful. So I'm really passionate about that. Stephanie, I'm really glad you brought up the appropriately resource this work piece of this. That is just like so obvious. So much of this relies on unpaid labor, unpaid labor for people who should be grateful to have the opportunity because they're being helped. And it's just like more work. So getting appropriate expertise, paying people and compensating them for that expertise, taking that expertise like seriously, not just box checking, all of that's really, really important. But just like, you have to spend money on it and you have to budget for that. Meaning you have to be proactive, not just like approving a special ad hoc expense because you later on figured out you have to pay for this. Like whether it's accessibility or whatever kind of inclusion, like you have to pay up because something is wrong with the way you're operating right now. And you need to figure out like how you're going to fix it. So I so appreciated that point. It's so important and urgent. And it's a proactive point when you have to like budget for it in advance when you're approving your budget, like the year before, not like special, okay, special expenses afterwards, because that's just like, it's like embarrassing. It's like super embarrassing. It's the way a lot of people operate because This is like a special initiative. This is like a special opportunity. It's like a gift I'm bestowing upon like employees who are asking for it. Like, it's just like, no thanks.
Thank you, Niran. A couple of words stand out. Intentionality. Plan it on the way in. Don't just tack it on the way out. And then this notion of charity. So many folks are supposed to be grateful they're being labored extra to put together the DE&I PowerPoint because, you know, we really want to value your culture. Well, if you wanted to value my culture, you wouldn't focus just on mine. You'd focus on the pluralism in our society and our organization, and you would put some resources to it, whichever that may be. So thank you for that. Stephanie, look at what you started with your book. So there you go. And you know, I'm sure others wrote it before that, but I blame you. Ibu, okay. What about you? What are you thinking about how you sustain this work?
Yeah, so I think there's two issues on the table, and I'd love to address both of these. And I wonder if we are getting to the end here, Jose. So both what Stephanie and Niran were saying about sustaining yourself. So like I can't imagine doing anything different. And I've been doing this, you know. I started IFYC, the idea hit me when I was 22 or 23 years old, and I did doctoral work along the way, but since 22 or 23, I've been building this organization. I'm 45 and I'm still building it. And part of the reason, first of all, that's just like being lucky, right? That's like winning the jackpot. And I realized that. And part of it is I'm not good at a whole lot of things, and that's not false humility, right? Like when I was a grad student at Oxford, like I had friends who were like, do I go to Harvard Medical School or Yale Law School? And I like am embarrassed about what my test scores were, right? I mean, they were good enough to get me to the University of Illinois, but not to any of the fancy schools that they went to, right? So there's a lot of things I'm just not good at. Like I didn't, you know, I tell my kids all the time, I got a 64.7 in pre-calculus. I begged my teacher for a C, and that was the last math course I ever took, right? And actually, there is actually a great gift to sucking at a lot of things, because you kind of have to just do what you're good at. Like you know, if you're elite educated, you know, a lot of people who are good at a lot of things, and they live under the anxiety of choices. I didn't actually have too many choices. There were many places who would not have wanted me, right? And so my passion and what I'm good at and what I, you know, and what I think is significant and what gives me joy on a day-to-day basis just happens to align, you know, and there's domestic dimensions of this also, as I like sit in our living room and I flip on every light switch to figure out which switch turns on the light right above me. And my wife turns to our kids and she's like, your father is not good at most things, but the things he's good at, he's very good at. Remembering which switch turns on which light is not in that category, right? Like there's like half of like stuff like that I am not very good at. But, you know, finding what you love, figuring out how to do that, taking as a gift the things that you're not good at, you'll never have anxiety about wondering whether you have to walk through that door because it's closed in your face. Thank the universe for that, you know. So the other thing is I have power, right? Like I, you know, and I don't have like mad social power, but I have power about what I do at IFYC and what I don't do, and part of that serves me because I get to do the things that I like to do. And part of that serves the organization because the organization gets me doing what I want to do. I think one of the greatest powers that anybody can have is the power to design their life and work to focus on the things that they care about. And I get to virtually do that with virtually every hour of my day. But, you know, and it is a crazy privilege, and there's actually very few people in the world with that privilege, right? But I honestly, I have it. So power has to be generous. I have to be generous with it, but I have that. On the diversity question, you know, I think it is clear to me identity and diversity will always matter and ought to always matter. And I came up in the movement and I started an organization in the broader field. And I'm also struck by how the discourses have changed over time. So when I was growing up as an Ismaili Muslim, the only thing I ever heard from my parents was how lucky I was. Now, you know, being named Ibu Patel in the western suburbs of Chicago in the 1980s, I didn't always feel lucky at Glencrest Junior High. But the discourse from my parents were, we have the final revelation, we have God's last prophet, and we have God's anointed guide in the Aga Khan. And it was actually a bit jarring for me to get to places where people assumed that I was oppressed and that I ought to look at myself as oppressed, because it was in such deep conflict with the lessons my family had given me, but also just like straightforward understanding of theology, right? I mean, virtually every Muslim believes that we have the final revelation and that we have God's last prophet, and that is a great gift, and it's something to be stewarded, right? I come up at late 1990s, early 2000s, when community development was in its asset-based moment. John McKnight, Jody Kretzmann, and it was actually viewed negatively to talk about people as if they couldn't do things, to use words like marginalized and oppressed. Now, I'm not suggesting that those words don't have value. I'm simply saying in a different moment in a field of social change, the language was very different and the frameworks were very different. And you can imagine in 10 years that the language and frameworks might be different. So identity will always matter. Diversity will always matter. The language and frameworks might change, right? And the groupings might change. So if we take a minute to reflect on the term people of color, what percentage of the world could we fairly describe as people of color? Just do the quick math. Basically, everybody outside of significant populations in the United States and Canada, Europe, Russia, Australia, New Zealand. Probably 80 to 85% of the world we would fairly describe as people of color. And then you ask yourself the question, are there useful generalizations to be made about 6 billion people? Maybe a moment for reflection, right? And so I want to fall in love with issue areas. I do not want to fall in love with every framework that's used in the moment. I want to consider the various frameworks, right? I do not want to fall in love with every frame, because I've been around for long enough to see the frameworks change. And because of how I present, I'm called oppressed by enough people that I need to like encourage them to have a Socratic moment and to please allow me to define myself. And I think I'm the luckiest person in the world for all the reasons I've shared here. Who else gets to start their own organization? Who else gets to design their days the way that I do? Who else gets to, you know, like think, have the theological gifts that I believe that I have? You know, my kids are healthy. My roof don't leak. I have food on the table. Alhamdulillah, right? Like, praise be to God.
Thank you, Ibu. So much to think about and process there. Self-awareness stands out. You know what's important. You remember your upbringing. You remember those three tenets that your folks gave you and that got you through Chicago. And that critical eye, you know, this work can unfortunately, and that's my word, not anybody else's, be so in the moment right now, a framework or a new ad campaign from Adidas or Nike or something along those lines. And so you have that critical eye. We all have that critical eye to be able to see through maybe some of the fog and remember what's important. And I'm not going to raise you, but I will call you 59.5 in Calc, the last math class I ever took. Thank God for statistics.
What a gift. What a gift. You went other directions.
I could have been an engineer and something probably would not have gone well. So thank you for that, Ibu. All right. I've only got 5 minutes and I do have time for one last question. And this one, it may not be easy, but it's going to be a short answer. You, all three of you, live in the space of equity, inclusion, and diversity and make our societies better. You may not think you do, but you do. Looking back to when you were a younger self, let's do college. Okay. You don't have to go all the way back to like third grade. What would you tell yourself now, right? What would you do? Knowing what you know now, knowing that this work is hard, but knowing that it's important, what might you tell yourself about this work so that you could sit there in your first year or second year dorm room thinking, gosh, I'm going to need something to get me through the days when I become X number of years and when I'm running a medical center in Boston or when I'm doing this incredible work. What do I really want to know now as an 18, 19, 20 year old to get me through to that part in life? It doesn't have to do anything with virtue, although it's all about character and virtue anyways. What would you say to yourself? Stephanie, you're up first. What would you say to a younger version of yourself?
I would say a version of something that Niran said earlier, which is find what brings you joy and then also celebrate those moments, especially in this work, celebrate the small victories and recognize that sometimes getting feedback that may feel like negative feedback can be an indication that you are actually doing something that's on the right path. Because people have to trust enough in your ability to course correct in order to provide that negative feedback.
Thank you so much, Stephanie.
I love it. Should I go, Jose? Yes. Okay. All right. Find your people, like find your people who you can lean on, who know you, who can tell you when like things are not right, or who can affirm you and celebrate you when things are right. And invest in them, and they're your people as you go along in life. Also, don't be afraid of awkwardness. Like, I think so much gets done in that like really weird space when you're doing something wrong or you're hearing that feedback or whatever else. Like, I never really like that. Like, I don't like disharmony, but like there is a lot that can be accomplished in the space of awkwardness. And so I wish I was more comfortable with that earlier. And just like know that like the goalpost will always change. Like you're never gonna be there if you're learning. And so like the kind of embracing of constant learning and like being okay with like getting it now and then like later on, like probably having to do more work, like that's okay. So I think those three things.
Thank you, Niran. Ibu.
Hey. I'm gonna go bang, bang, bang here, a handful of things. Wish for uncoolness early and embrace it. Everybody gets there someday. It's a gift to get it at 13. I got it at 9, greatest gift in the world. Embrace it early, number one. Number two, people are not nesting dolls. Do not believe that you can guess everything important about a person based on how they present. You cannot guess people's attitudes, their politics, their aesthetics, their taste based on a social identity. Don't do it. It doesn't make you smart. That would be number two. Number three, diversity is not rocket science. It's harder. And it is not just the differences you like. Expect disagreement. Expect tension. Doesn't matter how, like whatever your category is, there is internal disagreement. Expect it. And the fourth thing is the goal is not a more ferocious revolution. It's a more beautiful order. The goal is not a more ferocious revolution. It's a more beautiful order. And building things is infinitely harder than tearing them down.
If this were a stage, we've had three mics for you three to drop. Unfortunately, we have no stage. We are in a virtual confined space. I use a term a lot, and I don't use a term loose, and I don't use it loosely. I use the term unearned privilege. It has been an unearned privilege to be in this space with you three today. I'm grateful for our colleagues who put this together. I'm grateful for you all for saying yes. but it is beyond a gift. It is something not to squander. So from the bottom of my heart and from the top of my brain, I'm just extremely grateful to all three of you for spending this time, a Friday no less. Kenneth, I'm going to give it back to you. But before I do, Stephanie, thank you. Aran, thank you. Ibu, thank you.
Thank you.